Commissioner Monaghan repeatedly tried to undermine the governor's authority.
The McCain-Palin campaign offers a new take on Troopergate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 15th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the State Judicial Council recommends voters don't approve a Fairbanks area judge.
We received a number of reports and comments from people who work with Judge Cummings and who appear before Judge Cummings that were of concern to our council.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4 and then Alaska.
The John McCain-Sarah Palin campaign fired a volley at Troopergate allegations against Alaska's governor today. At a press conference at McCain campaign headquarters in Anchorage, former Palin press secretary Megan Stapleton said the campaign is releasing new information.
That the reassignment of the Department of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan had absolutely nothing to do with Trooper Mike Wooten and everything to do with Commissioner Monaghan's adamant refusal to join in Governor Palin's fiscal responsibility reform.
At the time of Monaghan's firing, Palin said there were too many unfilled trooper positions within the department, and there was a need to address law enforcement in rural Alaska. She didn't mention insubordination as a reason. Palin had also offered Monaghan the position of heading up the Alcohol and Beverage Control Board at the time she removed him as DPS commissioner. But today, Stapleton called former Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan's behavior, quote, egregious insubordination in light of Palin and Monaghan's differences over the state's public safety budget.
From the fall of 2007 to mid-2008, Commissioner Monaghan repeatedly tried to undermine the governor's authority by working against her and the administration over the Department of Public Safety's budget.
Stapleton cited Palin's move towards state fiscal reform as a source of friction between Monaghan and the governor. And Stapleton said the McCain campaign has copies of relevant emails that were submitted to the state's Personnel Review Board today. Copies of those emails were made available to the press. Stapleton was joined today by Ed O'Callaghan, a former New York special investigator, now working with the McCain campaign. The Department of Law has agreed to let the legislative investigator looking into the Monaghan firing interview state employees for which subpoenas were approved on Friday. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Among the 13 people whose testimony was considered important to the issue, seven of them are state employees who have not sought private counsel. As the push for them to testify to the investigator for the Senate Judiciary Committee increased, Senior Assistant Attorney General Michael Barnhill expressed concerns that the legislature was looking for possible criminal charges. He cited statutory support for his arguments. At a committee meeting Friday, Investigator Steve Branchflower concurred with Barnhill, saying it's the role of the Department of Law to bring criminal charges. And in a letter to Barnhill the same day, Legislative Council Chair Kim Elton said he agreed with the department's position, assuring Barnhill that criminal proceedings are not the purpose of the inquiry. With those assurances, Barnhill immediately notified the legislature that four Department of Administration officials are willing to give formal statements without any need for subpoenas, beginning with Commissioner Annette Kreitzer, who could be interviewed today. Barnhill says he'll have information on three other people he's prepared to represent by tomorrow. The availability of the other six people to whom the Senate committee issued subpoenas last week remains in question. Among those is Todd Palin, the governor's husband. A report on the legislative investigation is due October 10th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
In the November general election, Alaska voters will be asked whether or not to retain 12 judges across the state. But the Alaska Judicial Council is recommending that voters do not retain a judge in the district that includes Bethel and Fairbanks. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The Alaska Judicial Council is recommending that voters in the 4th Judicial District do not retain Judge Dennis Cummings. Cummings has been the district court judge in Bethel for about a year and a half. KYUK attempted to interview Cummings, but his court office said to contact his attorney in Anchorage, who did not return phone calls.
The council had a number of concerns.
Larry Cohn is the executive director of Alaska's Judicial Council.
In the course of our investigation, we received a number of reports and comments from people who work with Judge Cummings and who appear before Judge Cummings that were of concern to our council.
The Alaska Judicial Council is made up of three lawyers and three non-lawyers from around the state. Alaska's Chief Justice serves as the chair. Some of the council's main duties include screening and nominating candidates for judgeships and evaluating judges' performances for possible retention. To help the council decide who to retain as judges, they survey dozens of workers who have direct contact with the judge. For Cummings, that included nearly 200 workers, 74 attorneys with the Alaska Bar Association, 21 peace and probation officers, as well as several court employees and jurors. In the surveys, Cummings received good scores from the peace and probation officers, jury surveys, and court employees. But red flags went up with some of the responses the council got back from the 74 lawyers, who gave him below acceptable survey ratings in the areas of legal ability and temperament. Cummings scored much lower by attorneys specifically within the 4th Judicial District, who rated him below acceptable in four of the six categories, including legal ability, impartiality, judicial temperament, and overall performance. Cohn says the Judicial Council also reviewed an ethical complaint against Cummings that was filed with the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct.
And that conduct commission had found probable cause that Judge Cummings had violated several ethical canons relating to his contact with a state witness in a criminal case.
Because of his scores, the council decided to further investigate Cummings, conducting interviews in Bethel with the judge and those that work with him, about 40 interviews in all.
The council concluded that they had very considerable concerns about the judge's lack of impartiality, that the judge had inappropriate ex-party contact, which is contact with a witness in a case that he was presiding over, concerns about the judge's inability to control the courtroom, concerns about his legal knowledge, and also concluded that he had demonstrated a lack of candor.
Cummings started work in Bethel in 2001 in the district attorney's office. He became Bethel's district court judge 5 years later. He's lived in the state for about 40 years, graduating from law school in 1980. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission is recommending that Anchorage Mayor and U.S. Senate candidate Mark Begich be fined $1,420. Commission staff say Begich failed to disclose $15,000 in income his wife Deborah Bonito received as a shareholder of four different companies. The recommended civil penalty is $10 a day for the 142 days it took Begich to correct his state disclosure forms. Alaska Republican Party spokesman McHugh Pierre had filed the complaint against Begich. The APOC staff report says most of Pierre's allegations were based on his misunderstanding of differing federal and state reporting requirements and time periods, but seven of the allegations had merit. In a statement, Begich says all his financial information was publicly disclosed on either his state or federal forms. APOC staff declined to comment on the case until the commission issues a final decision. That's expected at the commission's regular meeting in Anchorage on September 26th. Begich is running against incumbent U.S. Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens has been charged with seven felony counts for failing to report more than $250,000 in gifts, including a major renovation of his Girdwood home, from oil industry executives. Stevens' trial starts September 24th in Washington, D.C. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, reeling in ancient shark fossils in Southeast.
We're trying to look at some of the oldest known examples of these things.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The Bush administration has extended the comment period for its proposed revision of the Endangered Species Act. The deadline for the public to weigh in was initially today, but the Interior Department has extended it until October 15th. The proposed revision of the law that protects America's endangered wildlife raised an outcry from environmentalists. Last month, a group of Democratic senators wrote to Interior Department Secretary Dirk Kempthorne and asked him to withdraw the plan, or at least extend the public comment period from 1 month to 6. Interior Department spokesman Chris Polino says the added 30 days should give more people time to weigh in.
Several requests were made to extend the comment period, to allow more time to prepare comments, to allow a broader number of people to express their views, and we wanted to accommodate that.
The proposal says federal agencies looking to do construction or development projects would be able to make more decisions without an independent review from the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service. It also says federal agencies shouldn't have to worry about the impact of global warming when giving the green light to local projects. The changes were inspired in part by the listing in May of the polar bear as a threatened species. The Interior Department called the revisions narrow. But environmentalists say the Bush administration is trying to force last-minute changes before leaving office and that the guidelines favor big industry at the expense of protecting animals. Southeast Alaska's biggest timber mills are long gone due to changes in government policy and the global market. But small mill operators continue to turn out lumber and specialty products on Prince of Wales Island. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Keith Landers makes shingles out of trees from Southeast Alaska's rainforest. But before his H&L salvage company can slice blocks of wood into roofing and siding, it has to cut the trees up into blocks of wood.
What they're doing here is they're chopping the wood into size for us so that we can split it. And he'll take all the garbage out, take a lot of the knots out, and basically cut it right into the right size for the machine.
The machine, which is decades old, cuts classic roofing shingles. They're sold to a British Columbia firm that treats and markets them, and most end up on houses in England.
We run about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8 cord of wood a day through here. And we'll be able to roof about a house a day is what we put out in product, about one roof a day.
Landers Mill, which also produces dimensional lumber, is one of about 24 on Southeast's Prince of Wales Island. About half are in or near Thorn Bay, a former logging camp on the island's east side. That's Karen Peterson's home base. She works for the University of Alaska's Cooperative Extension Service and has helped the mills work out timber buying agreements with the U.S. Forest Service.
You know, they're not doing large volume stuff. They're sawing, you know, special wood, custom cut wood. Some of them are doing real value-added stuff with dry kilns and planers and so forth, and they've got real unique markets that they're marketing to. So there is an alive and well small timber industry on Prince of Wales Island.
Another company is Thorn Bay Wood Products. Joanne Cabe and her husband Rick started out about 10 years ago producing rough-cut lumber, but that didn't do the trick.
It was getting where, you know, you're either going to go through wood like crazy and just sell it, or you can use less wood and make it more finished.
They expanded about 4 years ago, adding a kiln for drying and a planer for finishing and shaping. Cabe says they now make cabin logs, siding, decking, and custom lumber for island customers.
You have a lot more hours than the wood. We joke about naming pieces because you handle them so many times between the mill and loading them in the kiln and unloading them and planing them and sorting them. Mm-hmm. You have a lot more time into each wood, but it's neat to see the finished product come out of the planer, and it's also neat to see what people do with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're making their projects, and they give you pictures to show you some of what they've done. That's pretty fun.
Mill operators used to buy wood from the Ketchikan Pulp Company sort yard in Thorn Bay, but after KPC shut down in the late 90s, they had trouble getting enough wood. Since then, the Forest Service has provided smaller timber sales tailored to their needs. Some owners worry Sea Alaska Corporation's proposed land selections on the island could impact their supply. But the selections require federal legislation, and nothing seems to have gained momentum in Congress yet. Extension agent Peterson says workers' compensation is a bigger problem these days than timber supply.
It's a real barrier for them hiring a lot of employees because they can't afford the insurance to cover them. So a lot of people operate the mill themselves, and some of them have some employees, and some of them have some part-time employees. Other people will contract out specific things like the logging or the hauling, but it's real difficult.
The island's small mills have drawn praise from the timber industry as well as environmentalists. Logging advocates point to operators as tradition bearers who continue to provide jobs in an area with high unemployment. Green groups point to the production of value-added products that remain in the region, and they like the small timber sale program, which uses dead and down timber. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
Last Friday, Anchorage's new Dena'ina Convention and Civic Center hosted its first event. The sneak preview of the 215,000-foot square facility drew about 200 people, including KSKA's Len Anderson.
The promoted occasion was the hanging of Constellation, an incandescent cascade of Alaskan sea and land mammals, birds, and fish made of glowing resin. Artist Roger Helmick's artwork begins about 30 feet below the 100-foot-high atrium ceiling and descends to about 15 feet above the floor. Its half-completed status provided a backdrop for a series of speakers, including Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich, gleefully touting the nearly finished $110 million-plus project.
Today we are thrilled to announce the building is just days away. Just days away from completion.
The new Dena'ina Center has over four times the floor space of Anchorage's Egan Convention and Civic Center, built in 1984. The Dena'ina is finishing on schedule and within cost. Rather than property taxes, the construction bonds are being covered primarily by a voter-approved increase in the municipality's hotel and motel bed tax. The center's size impresses. Downstairs, at street level, there's a 50,000-square-foot exhibit hall, which can hold over 275 booths or host as many as 3,300 people for sit-down meals. The second floor features meeting rooms, and the third floor, a 25,000-square-foot ballroom. The first paid-for event occurred Saturday with a Sarah Palin for Vice President political rally. That will be followed by a series of warm-up events during the remainder of September. According to Julie Soppy, president of the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau, next month the new facility hits full stride.
In total, 24 of 31 days in October have groups in this new facility. This include galas, a national touring comedian, conventions, trade shows, corporate meetings, and there's even a wedding already booked in this beautiful facility.
The biggest October event, lasting 6 days, is the First Alaskans Institute's Elders and Youth Conference, followed immediately by the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention. Several thousand will attend the latter, and according to Bill Dugdale, Convention Bureau Facility Manager, they'll use all the new building has to offer.
So the FN has the entire building, which they're very excited about because they had really outgrown the Egan Center. So this gives them a lot of space to hold their events. They can expand their trade show because we now have the large space on the ground floor. It's 50,000 square feet.
The first two audience rows at Friday's Dena'ina Center sneak peek were reserved for special guests, most of whom were Dena'ina, who participated in the naming of the facility and guiding its artwork. Dorothy Cook is president of the Native Village of Aklutna, which lies within Anchorage's municipal boundaries. Cook read from a 2006 village resolution that had urged the Anchorage Assembly to adopt Dena'ina as the center's name.
The Native Village of Aklutna, various other Dena'ina communities, such as Tyonek and Kenai and Kinnick, our distinguished elders and our precious youth deserve cultural respect, recognition, and a sense of belonging to the community at large.
Until the center, no municipal building in Anchorage was named in tribute to the region's first people. That tribute is found throughout the center. each animal in Helmick's very large artwork had to receive elder approval. There'll be a 26-by-12-foot stained glass window by James Grant depicting the Dedina subsistence lifestyle. Meeting room artwork by Sonia Kelleher Combs and Kathleen Carroll. Plus a traditional Athabascan fish trap by artist Alan Dick of Lime Village. The trap provides the logos for the new center. Every meeting room bears an Athabascan name. Even outside, a mosaic of traditional porcupine quill design graces the intersection. The official public grand opening of the Dedina Center occurs October 18th and 19th. The same weekend, the first trade show takes place in its exhibition hall. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
And by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
The Alaska Sea Life Center staff successfully released two harbor seal pups back to the wild on Friday afternoon. KBBI's Emily Schwing was there.
Are we ready?
Yep.
It didn't take two rescued harbor seal pups long to wiggle down the beach and swim off in front of a crowd gathered on Homer's Bishop's Beach. The two pups, Muffler and Diesel, were rescued earlier this summer through the Alaska Sea Life Center's Rescue and Rehabilitation Program. Tim Lebling is the stranding coordinator at the center in Seward. He says he doesn't doubt these two particular harbor seals will do well in the wild.
The animals, when they first come in, they're usually about 1 to 5 days old. These are the orphan seals, the orphan harbor seals. It takes them about 6 to 8 weeks to actually start eating whole fish. Once they start eating whole fish or live fish, then they have to meet a certain release criteria, which is clinically healthy. They have to pass a series of disease screenings to make sure that they didn't come in with any type of disease or going back out with any known marine mammal diseases. And then they have to meet a certain release weight, which for harbor seals is 25 kilograms or about 50 pounds. And then most importantly, they actually have to have the behavior and act like wild animals.
Cameron Corbell is 11. He and his parents found one of the seals back in May.
We found him out at the one of the Russian villages. We were driving down there because my parents, they got a report that there was a seal down there, and so we went down to check it out, and there's a little pup.
It seems like you found other seals.
Yeah, we found a couple other ones before, but this is the first time I saw one of the releases.
Harbor seal pups are abandoned each year, and a few more will be released near Anchor Point next month. Lebling says the Sea Life Center's rescue and rehabilitation team makes an effort to keep rescued animals wild.
And that's one of our biggest things that we stress at the program, is that they have very little human interaction. So all their food is being fed through cannons or pipes, so that we're not hand feeding them. We don't talk to the animals. We don't reward the animals. So it's a very unique experience that we don't treat them like the collection animals or like we treat our pets.
Lebling adds that the Sea Life Center can't and shouldn't help every stranded animal, but those that are rescued provide researchers with plenty of information about what's happening out at sea.
It's really keeping a thumb on the pulse on what's going on with the marine ecosystem. So we test all these animals, and if there is some type of disease screening or some type of disease or something going on with the marine ecosystem, these animals are going to be the first animals that are going to show that, because we're going to be bringing them in. We by far don't bring in every animal in the state. We know that, and that's why it's important to bring the dead animals in as well, so that we can figure out exactly why they did die.
One of the harbor seals was fitted with a satellite tag, allowing the center to track and gather information about its whereabouts. Sightings of sick and stranded marine animals can be reported to the Alaska Sea Life Center's 24-hour hotline, 1-888-774-LIFE. In Homer, I'm Emily Schwing.
Researchers have located the remains of ancient sharks in southeast Alaska. As KRBD's Jay Marble reports, until recently, these sharks were only found in Europe and Russia.
You can see the three cusps were coming off right there. Very, very small. These are actually small examples.
Forest Service geologist Jim Bachtel is pointing out all the small black teeth poking out of pieces of Southeast Alaska limestone. Teeth are usually the only shark part to make it through the fossilization process. Sometimes some cartilage is found, and occasionally pieces of the spine. In this case, Bachtel and John Macy, who's a curator of paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, are excited because they found all those things.
We've got these big spines that stick out of the back of the shark fin. The two fins on the back, they stick out. And we've also got some pieces of what are probably parts of the jaw and the gill arches and things like that.
But Macy is interested in those teeth. They were actually first located in Alaska in the 1970s during a U.S. geological survey. But for a variety of reasons, they were forgotten until Jim Bachtel and Ray Troll from Ketchikan set out to relocate them. Eventually, they did, though Bachtel says they don't want to say where in Southeast they were found.
At that time, we collected a few pieces and John came back saying, you know, you have more than just teeth here, that you also have this cartilaginous stuff preserved in these spines. And
Bachtel wants people to remember that shark teeth found on public land are not to be disturbed. If teeth or other parts are found, the best bet is to call a scientist. These particular teeth are likely over 300 million years old. Macy says this is from the earliest period of sharks, from a geologic time known as the Devonian period. Back in those days, when sea creatures were just beginning to have jaws, these sharks would have been breaking news.
I like to say, if you could go fishing, you know, 375 million years ago, you'd haul up things that would look somewhat familiar, but you'd also bring up things that you wouldn't have a clue what they were. They'd be gigantic armored things with big bony plates on their heads and other funny fishes that had spines sticking out of all their fins and things like that. So we know there's a lot of very early experimentation and diversification going on back then. But we also see the first fossils of fishes that are very similar to major groups today, like the ray-finned fish and the lobe-finned fishes and stuff like that, and sharks. So we're trying to look at some of the oldest known examples of these things.
Macy says that these sharks have been discovered in Europe and the Ural Mountains of Russia and are now being found in Southeast Alaska reveals ancient patterns that are no longer obvious.
It's more evidence that there was some kind of geographical connection between this region and that part of the world back then when the continents all had a different configuration and, you know, there were oceans extending across these regions which weren't so far away as they are today.
Macy and the others will continue to look for shark fossils in the limestone of Southeast Alaska. Even if they don't find more, they hope to take what they have and drop it into acid. That will almost certainly reveal more teeth and possibly expose fins and other more exotic parts. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Jay Marble in Craig. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, a proud supporter of cultural activities that enrich the lives of all Alaskans. Wells Fargo, the next stage. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.